supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As he prepares to serve as Pennsylvania's top law enforcement officer, incoming State Attorney General Josh Shapiro is touring cities to get feedback on major issues. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports that Shapiro was in Philadelphia today to discuss gun violence.
The first time John Solomon picked up a gun, he was 11 years old. Soon-to-be State Attorney General Josh Shapiro asked him why.
And why did you carry it?
It was no particular reason why I carried it. Outside of it was a common thing to do.
Solomon's 24 now and served almost 5 years in prison for assault with a firearm.
My family members suffered because of the actions that I committed, but I didn't know that at the time when I was in the streets. I was young and I was misguided. I didn't have any empathy.
Now, Solomon works with his uncle, Daryl Schuler, as an anti-violence advocate in North Philly. They were among the more than 20 people who spoke at the forum, which also included the sheriff, police commissioner, and district attorney. A common theme was a lack of funding for the patchwork of small organizations like Schuler's that work on the ground in violent neighborhoods and know both the victims and the criminals personally.
It's kids that don't have clothes. They don't have places to live. I'm telling you, they're taking boarded houses up, unboarding them up, and living in them.
Many of these kids, Schuler says, turn to drug dealing to make money, and guns are the tools of the trade. Schuler says he's not sure what the state attorney general can do to help, but appreciated the opportunity to tell Shapiro what he sees every day. Shapiro says he wants his office to partner with local organizations, expand the Philadelphia Gun Violence Task Force, and collect more data on how illegal guns used in crimes are trafficked in the state. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
Attorneys for Green Party candidate Jill Stein hope that a Philadelphia judge will be the first to give them access to voting machines and software so that they can look for signs of hacking in the presidential election. WHYY's Dave Davies reports on the latest in Stein's quest for a Pennsylvania recount.
For a week now, Stein campaign attorney Ilan Mazel has made the case in one court after another that the voting machines used in Pennsylvania could have been hacked by a foreign power.
These DRE machines are vulnerable, they're hackable, they're a big black box, and inside that black box is Pennsylvanian democracy. We want to get inside that box and make sure that every vote was counted accurately.
No judge or election board has yet permitted Stein's computer experts to probe the machine software because they presented no evidence anything was amiss. But they think they have a shot in Philadelphia, where a recount permitted in 75 Philadelphia precincts did not include a digital audit of machines. Mazel appealed to Common Pleas Court, where the argument is not about Russians or whether there's any evidence of hacking. It's a simpler question.
The law allows presidential candidates to examine the voting system, to examine the machines.
He's right. Right there in the Pennsylvania Election Code, it says in a recount you can examine the machines.
And that doesn't mean standing there like a potted plant. It means looking behind the machine to make sure that the votes were counted accurately. That's what we believe examine means.
The judge in the case is Abby Fletman, who spent years as an election lawyer before joining the bench. She listened carefully to the arguments and read from her own copy of the election code on the bench as she weighed them. Republican Party lawyer Jonathan Goldstein said Stein's lawyers shouldn't get to open up the voting machines.
They're not entitled to it under the statute. There's a process. The process has to be observed. And a bunch of lawyers coming down from New York trying to upset that process is not really what the people of Pennsylvania deserve.
Judge Fletman is expected to rule soon. Meanwhile, a hearing on a separate recount suit in federal court is set for Friday. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The Southern Poverty Law Center website homepage refers viewers to a hate map that, as of 2015, included almost 900 groups operating in the United States. Let's focus on trends in our region and the nation with Mark Potok, senior fellow at the SPLC. Mark, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The trends, or at least this map, details trends from around the year 1999, and we see a peak and then an ebb, and only most recently did it surge again.
Well, that is true. I mean, what I would say, though, overall, is that the number of hate groups is very high. It's true it declined for a couple of years and then went up again last year. But we are still looking at counts that are around 900, which is vastly higher than what we saw during the 1990s. You know, I would say the other thing to understand is that we list an entirely different kind of group, so-called patriot groups or militia groups that believe the federal government is involved in some kind of conspiracy against the freedoms and liberties of the American people. And those groups have expanded absolutely enormously, going right back to when Barack Obama was first elected in 2008.
Though, as you cite patriot groups and militia groups, are they distinguished from what are referred to as anti-government groups? And is that latter category also considered in the hate category?
They are the same as anti-government extremist groups, and they are not listed in the hate group listings. And the reason for that is that, unlike hate groups, these are groups that aren't based on animus toward a particular group of people, all black people, all white people, all Jews, that kind of thing. Instead, they believe, in essence, that there is a cabal of people running the federal government who are about to impose martial law on the country. That will then, or so they imagine, be followed by a national gun seizure in which guns from all non-agents of the state will be taken. Anyone who resists will be thrown into concentration camps that they claim have been secretly built by the Federal Emergency Management Agency over the last several years. And ultimately, the idea is we will be forced as a nation into a kind of one-world socialistic government, the so-called New World Order. So they're essentially about conspiracies and believing that the elites, meaning the government, are out to get the rest of us.
FBI numbers point to a surge in anti-Muslim hate crimes. Is that incorporated in your work as well?
Well, we certainly think that that is correct. All the evidence suggested that there would be a surge, and in fact, the surge was remarkable. What it showed was a 67% increase in anti-Muslim hate crimes in 2015 over 2014. I think it bears remembering that, of course, 2015 included about 6 months of the Trump campaign, which spent an awful lot of time defaming Muslims and talking about banning them from the country and that sort of thing. Of course, there were also a number of Islamic State atrocities, quite incredible ones, in 2015 that also helped provoke this wave of hate crimes.
And in terms of place, let's go to Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. What are some of the highlights of the map there?
What I could tell you is that over the last few years, we have seen an awful lot of skinheads, neo-Nazi skinheads, in those states. New Jersey particularly had a very real problem for quite a while. The other thing I would say is that the Northeast and the Atlantic seaboard in general tends to have more of the black supremacist or black separatist hate groups that we list than other parts of the country. Those groups tend to locate, you know, in the New York cities, the Baltimores, the Philadelphias, places like that, as opposed to out in the, you know, in the country, in the Deep South, essentially, where I am, where you tend to find much more Klan groups and that kind of thing.
Is it the center's assessment that the most recent presidential election campaign has, how shall I say, lower the bar or threshold for a type of speech that would be construed as hateful?
I think there's absolutely no question about it. You know, one has only to listen to the David Dukes of the world, to Klan leaders, to neo-Nazi leaders, and the leaders of similar kinds of groups who are almost universally just utterly thrilled by Trump's campaign and especially his victory. You know, many people in these groups now refer to Trump as our man in the White House, as our great leader, our glorious leader, that kind of thing. You know, I'm not trying to suggest that Donald Trump is just the same as some Klansmen out there. I don't think that's the case, and I don't even think the Klan thinks that's the case. But he has done an awful lot in terms of legitimizing the kinds of hatreds that these groups thrive on. You know, I think, let's not forget, this is a man who actually started his presidential campaign last year with a speech describing Mexican immigrants as rapists and drug dealers. And that kind of talk has continued virtually throughout the campaign.
Mark Potok, thanks so much for taking time to join us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mark Potok, senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Still ahead this evening, the authors of a new musical changed their tone when rehearsals started on Election Day.
They say, you know, you can't be brave if you're not scared. You know, it can't be funny if you're not a little sad first.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. We'll be right back.
Doylestown Health's Richard A. Rife Heart Institute supports WHYY, recently named one of the top 100 hospitals and health systems with great heart programs by Becker's Hospital Review. The Heart Institute offers advanced cardiac procedures close to home. Specialized care is available for heart attacks, heart valve disease, atrial fibrillation, and other cardiac arrhythmias. More information is available at doylestownhealth.org/heart.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. If you live in an urban area, you might have noticed large groups of crows congregating in noisy roosts. From the Allegheny Front, Penn State University's Margaret Brittingham explains this annual phenomenon.
Crows are known for their intelligence. Just ask anybody who's tried to get crows to move away from their roosting sites. The large flocks of crows in our region now are primarily migrants that are here to spend the winter. The number of roosting crows tends to build up steadily through November and December. These large winter roosts were historically in rural areas, but over time, as crows adapted to people, they moved their winter roosts into urban areas. Here, they benefit from the warmth of the city. They are attracted to well-lit areas, which may enhance their ability to detect approaching predators. Their roosts can number up to hundreds of thousands of birds. Roosts are most common in medium-sized cities with easy access to rural lands. The crows roost in the city during the night, then at dawn they scatter, often flying more than 10 miles to feed in fields and neighborhoods. In mid-afternoon, the birds gather in pre-roosting groups. As the day progresses, flocks band together, forming larger and larger flocks. Just before dusk, the assembled group disperses. The flocks form lines across the sky. Crows call as they fly into the roost, perhaps encouraging their compatriots to join them. As dark settles, they crowd together. They roost in dense clusters in trees on urban streets and parks. These migrant crows, winter visitors to the area, are occasionally joined by some of the townies. These are the resident crows. They include the crows that might have nested in local backyards over the summer. Research has shown that the locals who join the roost tend to be the teenagers. They are birds that may have helped mom and dad raise young, but don't have their own territory. The older birds tend to stay at home and don't go down to the roost. Crow roosts are considered traditional, meaning they occur in the same area year after year. Younger birds learn roost locations from older members of the flock. In late February, early March, the roost breaks up as crows depart and migrate north for breeding. So next time you see lines of crows darkening our skies at night, take a minute to marvel in the wonder of these smart, social birds. I'm Margaret Brittingham.
The Allegheny Front covers environmental issues in Pennsylvania, and there's more at AlleghenyFront.org. By the way, bird sounds courtesy of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. A new holiday play opens tomorrow in Philadelphia. The Carols is a musical set during World War II. Three sisters in New Jersey are having a difficult time staging Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol because most of the men in town are serving overseas. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the play tries to include the national mood after this year's presidential election.
It's an upside-down little world we live in.
This musical began its life when most holiday plays start, in July. That's when writer Jennifer Childs and composer Monica Stevenson sat down to start writing The Carols. They came up with a story set in 1943, which would have been the first Christmas many Americans were away from home to fight overseas. Stevenson said 1943 was a tough year, but the music was buoyant.
There is a certain levity to the music of the 1940s, you know, so it does have that triumphant, happy, you know, everything is going well sound that I think we hear in a lot of the Andrew Sisters numbers of that time period, even big band music.
You won't see me a marrying a rich totalitarian.
With a script in hand and an armful of songs, 1812 Productions started putting together a show. The first day of rehearsal was Election Day.
After the first week of rehearsal, mm-hmm. we as a country were made very aware of the state of things. I had no idea our country was so divided.
At the very last minute, they decided to make some changes in the play to follow the mood of one of the biggest election upsets in American history. That change was subtle. They shifted the time period from 1943 to 1944. That may have been just 1 year, but director Jennifer Childe says 1944 was after the horrific slaughter of D-Day. That's when many Americans were weary of war. They were tired of rations. They were wondering when they could put this all behind them.
You know, you talk about that different lens. You talk about shifting from 43 to 44. All of a sudden, the lens is different. Shifting from November 8th to November 9th, the lens was different. All of a sudden, there are lyrics in this show that, you know, things like it's an upside down little world we live in, that were kind of cute and fun and fluffy on day one, and day two it was like, oh my god, it's an upside down little world.
The show was new again. Yeah. All the lines were new, all the lyrics mm-hmm. were new, the music was new. We were discovering new things.
I pray to God with all my heart this war will stop and life will start.
Like many performances created by Jennifer Childs, this comedy has a serious core at its heart.
They say, you know, you can't be brave if you're not scared, you know? It can't be funny if you're not a little sad first, I guess.
The Carols runs until the new year. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
SEPTA's Route 47 bus goes from Whitman Plaza in South Philadelphia to Olney in North Philly. The trip brings together immigrants and refugee communities from Asia, Africa, Europe, and Latin America. Most of the time, their stories go untold. Mural art Shira Walensky and Laura Deutsch documented stories from riders of Route 47 and wrapped bus number 8253 with them. The decorated bus will be cruising its route until December 13th. WHYY's Catalina Jaramillo spoke with the artists and some of the passengers.
Service to South Philadelphia.
So where do you get on? What's your bus stop?
Part of the goal overall of this past year has been to connect the refugee communities in South Philadelphia that Southeast by Southeast has been working with for a long time to other incredibly small and unknown communities, unknown to a lot of the city.
First time in Philadelphia on the bus. What? How did you feel?
Afraid.
Scared.
Yeah. Talking to some people who had never actually been on a bus, who came from a refugee camp, and hearing about, like, well, I didn't know where I was supposed to put money, and I didn't know, you know, that first ride for someone.
In Nepal, we speak Nepali, and it would be easier for us. Here, they will not understand our language, and we find quite difficult.
And we were also interested in kind of how do you bring more attention to not just kind of what's happening in South Philly and Southeast by Southeast, but these kinds of community initiatives that are happening all over the city. And so I think the bus line and the bus was kind of an obvious way to think about that, and buses have nice metaphors about journey and travel. And
you take the bus every morning and see the whole world on your way to work, and I thought that was just the coolest thing, and it was really eye-opening. And just to hear other languages on the bus, just to see people, how they interacted differently, and it was really, really eye-opening for me.
And there have been so many negative comments around immigration and building walls, so I think a project that really shows, like, actually this is a really positive part of our city.
There's just all kinds of characters. And I like to imagine stories. Who are you? What are you thinking? You know, just what's your life like? Where are you going?
Once you go in the bus, mm-hmm. it's like you're in a little community mm-hmm. where if somebody needs help, you reach and you help them with their bags or with the strollers.
That was exactly what I think we are trying to do, which is show that this bus represents just this rich, diverse corridor of Philadelphia. When you go on the bus, basically you're traveling through worlds.
The bus is still like one of these few dying quasi-public spaces where people are forced to be together, and I just think there's fewer and fewer of those spaces and more option, more ways to opt out of being in those spaces. And so I hope people might kind of take the route and see what it's like to like be in that experience where you see things that are in a language you don't understand, or you're around people that otherwise you're not interacting with.
You can see the bus and hear the rider's stories on Tuesday at noon at Franklin Square Park. And finally this evening, the Grammy nominations were announced today. Philadelphians popped up in five different categories, with two hometown favorites going head-to-head in one of them. For Best Opera Recording, Curtis Institute professor and composer Jennifer Higdon's Cold Mountain has been nominated for a performance by the Santa Fe Opera Orchestra. In the same category, Philadelphia Orchestra music director Yannick Nezet-Séguin's recording of Mozart's Le Nozze di Figaro with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe has also been named. Jennifer Higdon might have a bit of an edge. Her Cold Mountain is also nominated for Best Contemporary Classical Composition. The Grammys will be awarded February 12th. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.